Stay tuned now on 1460 WVOX for The Ballot Box with your hosts Tamar Tate and Nita Lubin. The Ballot Box is a monthly program brought to you by the League of Women Voters of New Rochelle. Now, The Ballot Box on 1460 WVOX.
Good morning and welcome to The Ballot Box. I'm Tamar Tate and I'm joined by my co-host Nina Lubin. And we're coming to you on behalf of the League of Women Voters of New Rochelle, courtesy of WVOX 1460 AM, and our talented sound engineer, Gerald Bell. So, Nina, how are you doing this morning?
I'm doing okay, and glad to speak with you this morning, Tamar. How am I doing? Well, I'm encouraged by two significant government defense moves against the COVID that have just occurred in the last couple of days. Hot off the presses for those who haven't yet heard, in the COVID mask arena, the government's planning to release 400 million N95 masks to health centers and pharmacies, all made in the U.S., all free, and all delivered, fingers crossed, in the next 1.5 to 2 weeks. Second, in the testing arena, home COVID tests are now available for free at covidtests.gov, up to 4 per person, anticipated 7 to 12 days after ordering, covidtests.gov. So, Tamar, this is a kind of national action I personally have been waiting for and am glad to see happening. And speaking of action, I know you have more about action at the local level.
Yeah.
Do tell.
Actually, I was at my computer as soon as possible yesterday ordering my free COVID test, so fingers crossed. But we have a wonderful and timely show planned today. Before we introduce our guest, I just want to circle back briefly to December's show when we discussed redistricting with Professor Jeffrey Weiss of the New York Census and Redistricting Institute of New York. A lot of listeners might be wondering about the next round of redistricting that's going to be affecting our local communities now that the state's redistricting effort is winding down. And to address the basics of county redistricting, the League of Women Voters is going to be offering a Zoom event on January 27th at 6:30 p.m., and it's going to be featuring none other than Professor Weiss, along with a staffer from the Office of Assemblywoman Amy Paulin, and we're also going to have a League of Women Voters representative from the City of Rochester's Redistricting Committee. And this event is 100% free, and it's open to anyone that's interested. And if you are interested in gaining a better understanding of redistricting's next steps, I invite everyone to join us for this very important presentation. And all you have to do is email millie@lwvny.org. That's millie@lwvny, League of Women Voters New York, .org, and she will send you the Zoom link. Again, this event's going to be on January 27th. At 6:30 p.m. So now, without further ado, let's shift over to the topic of today's show.
Okay, yeah. I'll take it from here. Perry Grossman is a civil rights attorney in New York. Let me briefly break that down for you. First, for close to 5 years, Perry has been senior staff attorney with the Voting Rights Project at the New York Civil Liberties Union. He is, in other words, a key participant in the fight to protect every New Yorker's right to vote and to keep New Yorkers informed about threats to their rights. Perry shares his voting rights expertise with lawyers-to-be as an adjunct professor at Fordham University School of Law and shares it with others in publications and on panels and in seminars. He also maintains his legal watch in private practice at the law office of Perry Grossman. And that was just the thumbnail sketch. Listeners who know the League of Women Voters, even if only the name, should know that its difficult birth centered around women's right to vote, and that its 100-plus-year existence has continuously upheld the right to vote as fundamental to our democracy, downright sacred. It's therefore important to have Perry with us today during what has been described as a very challenging time for our democracy. He's going to do one of the things he does best, inform us about the health of our right to vote. So good morning, Perry, and welcome to the Ballot Box.
Good morning, Nina and Tamar. It's such a pleasure to be with you both.
Very glad you found time to join us this morning.
League of Women Voters
so much.
Great and constant partner of ours. So anytime I can partner with the League of Women Voters to help educate the public about what's going on in our voting and elections, it is my pleasure and privilege to do so.
Thank you so very much. We really appreciate that. And, let's jump right in. We are using our show this morning to bring our listeners up to speed on a topic that's increasingly prominent in the headlines and also increasingly contentious, voting rights. So the question we have for you is, what is this about and where did it come from?
Sure. So I think it's important to understand sort of the arc of history when it comes to voting rights, and then hopefully that puts the current battles in some context, right? So obviously the right to vote is fundamental to a representative democracy that we live in. It is the way by which the people hold their elected representatives accountable to make sure that they are acting in the public interest, and to make sure that they are producing the policy outcomes, the form of government that the people want to see. And for, you know, most of the first century of our republic, you know, the right to vote was really limited largely to property-owning white men. And then, of course, the Civil War happens, and the Civil War amendments, the 13th, 14th, and 15th amendments to the Constitution. And that introduces the idea of broadening the right to vote beyond just those property-owning white men to people of color, men of color in particular. We don't see women's right to vote constitutionalized until the 19th Amendment in 1919. We don't see the right to vote of people 18 and over constitutionalized until the 26th Amendment in the 1970s. And so, you know, the concept of voting rights has really evolved over a long period of time and has been a constant fight from categorically excluding large groups of people from our democracy, right? Half of the participants in our democracy were excluded until the passage of the 19th Amendment. And functionally, people of color were excluded despite the passage of the 15th Amendment until the Voting Rights Act of 1965. And to understand how that worked, how jurisdictions were able to evade, you know, that constitutional protection for so long through a program of massive resistance, you know, it's important to understand why the Voting Rights Act of 1965 is such a watershed moment and what it really does. You know, up until that time, between, you know, 1870 and 1965, you know, we see all kinds of different barriers to the ballot erected. We see literacy tests. We see voter intimidation. We see organized groups like the Klan preventing registrars or voters from even registering black people. And to the extent that there are, we see white primaries where only white people were allowed to vote in primary elections. And the parties which ran the primary elections were able to, for a long time, until the Supreme Court outlawed it in Smith v. Albright.
Perry, okay. I'm sorry to interrupt. That music means we need to cut to a commercial, but let's pick up with that
and
after.
We'll be back.
Sure.
Let's return now to the Ballot Box with your hosts, Tamar Tate and Nita Lubin, brought to you by the League of Women Voters of New Rochelle. Once again, the Ballot Box on 1460 WVOX.
Hi, welcome back to the ballot box with our guest, Perry Grossman, civil rights attorney, who has rapidly been bringing us up to speed historically, and we ended before the break on the 1965 Voting Rights Act and why that is such a watershed moment in our right to vote. Perry,
thanks so much. So just to wrap up very quickly the pre-break history. There were a lot of games played in order to deprive people of the right to vote. Like I said, all those barriers to the ballot, the literacy test, the voter intimidation, making people guess the number of jelly beans in a jar. And there were a number of ineffective but well-intentioned civil rights acts along the way. But the 1965 Act is so important. And the crown jewel of the 1965 Act was something called preclearance. And preclearance said that states with the worst histories of discrimination, and they were identified through a formula that used voter registration rates by race to identify a group of states that would be required to pre-clear any changes to their election laws through either the U.S. Department of Justice or they could go through the Federal District Court in Washington, D.C. And that was such a revolutionary innovation in voting rights because it flips the burden of ferreting out discrimination from the voters who really don't have the time and the resources to investigate and prosecute all of the ways in which their right to vote might be abridged to the jurisdictions that are doing the discrimination to prove that they are not discriminating. And that really led to massive upticks in black voter registration, as there were other important provisions of the Voting Rights Act, including protections for language minority voters. We saw language access provided for the first time in amendments to the Voting Rights Act, which really enabled Spanish-speaking voters, Asian language-speaking voters to participate. And, you know, we saw a pretty steady increase in minority political participation over the years because of the Voting Rights Act in 1965. Unfortunately, in 2013, the Supreme Court in Shelby County struck that down. And it's important to consider the most recent reauthorization of the Voting Rights Act in 2006 in order to realize just what a frustrating and difficult to imagine place we're in now. In 2006, Congress looked at preclearance, which has to be reauthorized every so often, and said, we're going to reauthorize it for 25 years, and the Senate voted 96-0 to reauthorize it. And the House voted, I think it was about 393-30 to reauthorize it. And it was President George W. Bush that signed it into law. In order to figure out whether it should be reauthorized, the Congress held dozens of hearings, heard from expert witnesses, compiled tens of thousands of pages in their record, and the Supreme Court said that's simply not enough evidence to continue those protections. What has happened since that moment is really unfortunate. States that had otherwise been blocked from implementing laws that were clearly discriminatory, some intentionally discriminatory, immediately began implementing, some of them within hours of that decision, imposing voter ID laws that were not simply aimed at an idea of voter integrity, but really targeted towards allowing forms of ID and disallowing forms of ID that would disproportionately hurt black people, in particular in North Carolina, or Hispanic people in Texas and Arizona. The loss of that important, that crown jewel, that firewall, has really led to a lot of litigation that would not have otherwise occurred. And then more recently, the Supreme Court in the Brnovich decision made it more difficult to target those new laws because Justice Alito, in his majority opinion, said, well, you know, we shouldn't really look at, you know, we shouldn't be concerned about laws that only affect a small number of voters, although consider when a small number of voters is tens of thousands of voters and the margin of victory for a state is a few thousand voters like it was in Arizona and Georgia. So there's a number of things the Supreme Court has done to really disable the effectiveness of the Voting Rights Act. And so we've seen all of these new, really surgically targeted voter suppression laws, laws that are designed to make it unnecessarily harder to vote.
Perry, can you give just an example of a state law that discriminatorily suppresses a group's voting rights? And if it's so clear that that's happening, what's the argument that state legislatures make for such a law?
Sure. I'll point to a law that was passed in Texas. In the previous election, Harris County, Texas, enacted a bunch of administration measures designed to make it easier to vote in a pandemic. They enabled drive-through voting, right, so people could vote safely from their cars. They had certain offices open 24 hours that would allow people to vote at times when it was uncrowded. And the Texas legislature went through and zeroed out each of those provisions because they were used disproportionately by voters of color. There was nothing stopping other counties in Texas from similarly expanding access to the right to vote. You know, but you know, we've seen that. That is sort of one example. And in Georgia, this law prohibiting people from giving food or snacks or water to folks waiting in line, when we've got this demonstrated history of multi-hour lines at poll sites in black areas, is another example of just a gratuitous effort to suppress, in particular, black votes.
It'll be interesting to see the effect of everything that's going on in Texas, because in Texas, they have a March 1st primary. It's going to be the first of the midterms. And I know there's a lot that's been going on there. As many as half of the absentee ballot applications have been rejected so far down there because of the new rules. So that's an interesting state to watch. Perry, when you were going through the history, it brings us to this moment. It seems like a very historical moment. And right now we're on the precipice of this, you know, For the People Act of 2021. Could you just fill us in on that after the break when we come back?
It'd be my pleasure.
Thank you.
Let's return now to The Ballot Box with your hosts, Tamar Tate and Nita Lubin, brought to you by the League of Women Voters of New Rochelle. Once again, The Ballot Box on 1460 WVOX.
Welcome back. I'm Tamar Tate, and Nita Lubin and I are speaking with Perry Grossman from the NYCLU Voting Rights Project. And Perry was telling us about, basically giving us a thumbnail sketch of the history of voting rights in this country up until this moment, which brings us to this very historical week in Congress. Perry, maybe you could tell us a little bit about the legislation that is so in the news. What will this do to expand, or what won't it do, to expand Americans' access to the ballot box?
Sure. So there's two bills at issue. One is the Freedom to Vote Act, and the other is the John R. Lewis Voting Rights Advancement Act. And they're certainly closely related, but a little bit distinct. The John R. Lewis Voting Rights Advancement Act would update the coverage formula for preclearance to bring that back online in a way that's been inoperable since 2013. So that crown jewel of the Civil Rights Act, the Voting Rights Act, can really come back into force. The Freedom to Vote Act really takes a lot of good election practices that are present in lots of states and makes them a national standard. So we're not talking about a lot of revolutionary provisions. We're talking about, you know, requiring states to offer early voting. I think 40 states currently offer early voting. You know, no excuse absentee voting. That's actually available in a lot of states right now. Not New York, but lots and lots of red states, including Idaho, Kansas, Alaska, Arizona, Utah, Wyoming. And so bringing that to every state. You know, it makes Election Day a holiday. It actually includes a voter ID requirement, which is not necessarily my favorite thing because there's no evidence of in-person voter fraud. But at least it's a very expansive voter ID requirement that doesn't have the same sort of targeting problems that the strict voter ID requirements that have been struck down by Shelby County. There are crackdowns on deceptive and intimidating practices. I think that's a particularly valuable thing. Nobody should be deprived of their right to vote because of intimidation or deception. There are protections against partisan gerrymandering, right? We're seeing partisan gerrymandering occurring. It's a longstanding and widespread phenomenon. It has occurred in red states. It has occurred in blue states. It is not particularly good for democracy. And I think everybody recognizes that partisan gerrymandering is not good for democracy. But it's important to make that a rule for all states. Otherwise, you're going to see what we've seen, which is states where partisan gerrymandering is allowed, you will see legislatures gerrymandered to the hilt. And in other states that adopt independent commissions, you're going to see fairer maps there, but that may result in some problematic election results on a national basis. So I think that sort of redistricting reform is really, really important. I think fighting gerrymandering is something that would really help improve the state of democracy. And then we're modernizing voter registration. We here in New York, we recently enacted automatic voter registration. So of 18 other states in D.C., it would make automatic voter registration a national standard. This is taking people who are already eligible to vote and just making it easier for them to get on the rolls.
So, Perry, headlines are telling us that this is dead in the water. This is not going to happen in Congress. And I'm wondering, I can't speak for the two Democrats that are making this not happen. But why is there no Republican? What is the feeling, the fear, the reason that any of these things would not be, fully approved by every congressperson?
To be perfectly candid, I don't understand the genuine, if there's any genuine principle behind the opposition. You can walk through the Freedom to Vote Act, and you will find nationalized standards for practices that are occurring in states that are governed by Republican governors with Republican state legislatures. The renewal of preclearance, like I said, in 2006, that was signed by a Republican president, authorized by a unanimous Senate. So I really struggle to find a principled rationale for opposing this. So I don't necessarily want to speculate about what unprincipled rationales will occur, but the fact is we don't see any lack of election integrity, any fraud that would justify the restrictive voting laws that we're seeing. So these state laws that have been, rolling back and restricting voting rights really seem like an attempt to stop people from voting, more so than to enhance any sort of election security or integrity.
Well, Perry, how do you answer the argument that voting law is really the province of the state?
So there's no question that, states are different, and they do need to adapt practices to localities, but we have a national legislature. We have national offices. We elect people to those offices. And so it's important to have, one, some uniformity and best practices, because otherwise, we allow states to engage in sort of a race to the bottom in order for legislatures to privilege the voters that they like and to disfavor the voters that they don't like. And that shouldn't be happening. We should have, a clear consensus that, more eligible voters voting is good, and as many eligible voters who want to cast a ballot should be able to. But we're not seeing that. Instead, we're seeing some states really work hard on expanding access to the ballot, which I think is commendable, and we're seeing other states go in the other direction. There is an elections clause to the United States Constitution, which allows the federal government to step in and regulate federal elections over states because it is so important that there be this kind of baseline for democracy. And we are seeing that baseline erode recently.
Okay, that last part of your response, Perry, really brings home the point, Tamar, that this is permissible, that this is not, an illegitimate attempt, that this is not political, that there is a constitutional right for the federal government to step in.
There are so many constitutional bases for this law, or for this bill, I should say. Obviously we have the elections clause for sure. There is, of course, a federal role in regulating elections. But we also have anti-discrimination provisions.
Mm-hmm.
And, the 15th Amendment protects against voting discrimination on the basis of race. But, we also have laws that make it difficult for women who bear the brunt of childcare to vote. And when you're making it more difficult to vote, you are putting that additional burden on half the population. The 19th Amendment protects against that. When you are trying to restrict access to voting on college campuses, you're infringing upon the 26th Amendment, which prohibits voting discrimination on the basis of age. When you are limiting no-excuse absentee ballots, or absentee ballots even with an excuse, to a very small subset of the population, you may be discriminating against voters with disabilities. So I think there's a lot of bases for Congress to intervene here.
Okay, so that really closes the door on anyone who would argue, the states are in charge of voting. And that's what we do. I know we'll be breaking soon, Perry. I'd love to switch to the states, in particular New York, and find out what's going on there. And we'll return to that when we come back.
That'd be my pleasure.
Let's return now to The Ballot Box with your hosts, Tamar Tate and Nita Lubin, brought to you by the League of Women Voters of New Rochelle. Once again, The Ballot Box on 1460 WVOX.
Hello and welcome back, listeners. We're with Perry Grossman, New York voting rights expert. Skip the New York voting rights expert. And we want to move from what's happening in the federal arena to New York. And let me open that with this question, which comes from a League of Women Voters colleague. This past Sunday on Meet the Press, Senator Mitt Romney was asked by the host Chuck Todd about voting rights. And Senator Romney responded in this fashion, that even with the changes in Georgia's voting laws, new changes that limit drop boxes and limit times for absentee ballot, et cetera, even with those changes, Senator Romney says it would still be easier to vote in Georgia than it is in Delaware, New York, or New Jersey. In other words, our laws in New York are tougher than Georgia's laws. So there was no further discussion on it. The topic changed kind of abruptly. Perry, if you were there, how would you have responded to Senator Romney's comment?
I think Senator Romney's comment is utter nonsense. Senator Romney fails to acknowledge that the ability to vote is based on a whole concatenation of laws, right? We have different times for polling hours. We have different access to early voting. We have different access to absentee ballots, different access to registration procedures, and the way in which each state approaches those creates an overall cost of voting, right? To think about voting as an economic decision, right? You will vote when the rewards outweigh the costs. And the rewards of voting, as someone who loves voting deeply, I have to admit, are not great. You don't get paid for voting. You don't get anything other than sort of the expressive benefit and the ability to cast a ballot for your candidate who may or may not win. But the costs can get very high, and you can wait online, you can have your ballot rejected, you can have to follow up if your registration is missed, you can have to, all kinds of different things. And so you need to think about the entire voting environment as an economic decision. And there's actually an annual publication, The Cost of Voting in American States, that looks at that entire platform. New York is by no means the best state when it comes to the cost of voting. It's ranked 17th overall. New Jersey is 16th. Delaware a little bit lower than both of them. Georgia is 49th, the only state in which it is harder to vote in Georgia. And this is as of 2020. This is not even taking into account the most recent restrictions, is Texas. And that shouldn't come as a surprise to anyone who's been following that. And when you look at New York, certainly we have a lot of improvement to do. And we've been engaging in a lot of very positive pro-voter practices since the start of the 2019 legislative session. But, we need to keep doing more. But we have had, for a long time, the longest Election Day polling hours in the nation. It is generally fairly easy to get to your Election Day polling site. But we need to also improve access to early voting. We need to improve access to voter registration. So we've got a long way to go. But I would direct Senator Romney to look at the cost of voting in American states and rethink his answer.
Thank you very much. Is that online, by the way? You think we can find it?
It is. If you want, Google cost of voting in American states.
Of voting in American states. Good. I never knew such a thing existed. Thank you.
My pleasure.
Terry, I'm curious, what do you feel are the most obvious or egregious suppression tactics in state laws?
Oh, that's an excellent question. So we see them at every stage. Like, voter suppression can occur at any point in the continuum between eligibility to vote, registration, getting your ballot, getting to your polling place, having your ballot counted. So, I think there are suppression tactics that occur at every point. So, for one, to start all the way at the end, I think you mentioned that Texas is rejecting a lot of absentee ballot applications right now for really technical reasons. And that's a form of voter suppression, right? There's no reason that a person who can be verified as an eligible voter should have their absentee ballot application rejected. We see a lot of polling place movement. And in a state where you invalidate people who happen to cast a ballot in the wrong precinct, even if they're allowed to vote for some of those offices on that ballot, right? So I live in the Bronx, but let's say I for some reason happen to go vote in Yonkers. That would probably knock out my ballot for state assembly, for city council, for sure. But if I'm voting for governor, lieutenant governor, attorney general, I'm still entitled to vote for those offices. There's no reason to discount my ballot there than it is if I vote in the correct place. So that's called the wrong church rule, and that's going to be addressed this year. But for communities where your polling place moves a lot, and this is particularly low-income communities and communities of color, that is a form of voter suppression. When we have a lack of access to forms of registration, we require wet ink signatures or don't allow registration drives, right? We've seen states really try and burden groups like the League of Women Voters who go out and do such valuable voter registration drive work, by threatening criminal penalties for things that are, most likely mistakes. Those are all different sorts of voter suppression tactics that we're seeing. And Florida and Georgia and Texas right now are becoming especially creative. But again, the thing that makes these tactics so pernicious is not that they eliminate, millions of ballots with each law. It's that the people who are enacting these laws know who the laws are disproportionately affecting. And so they're able to shave a few thousand votes with each one of these practices. And in close elections, that can make a world of difference.
Yeah.
And then you have those crazy laws, apropos of nothing, it seems, where you're not even allowed to give water to people who are standing online for a few hours in the sun waiting to vote.
Yeah, I'd like to address a misconception about that, by the way. A lot of people have pointed to New York and said that New York and Georgia have the same prohibition on providing food and drink to people in line at polling places. And that is just categorically false. Georgia has a blanket prohibition. There are no exceptions to it. New York allows to provide snacks and water as long as the value of those snacks and water is under a dollar as indexed to inflation as of 1992. And you can't identify yourself as being affiliated with a candidate or party. But if you as a community group are there, you know, providing a table with water that you bought it at Costco to voters, there's nothing wrong with that. And no one would ever try to enforce that otherwise.
While we're in New York, Perry, what is the current status of the New York Voting Rights Act?
Oh, I'm so glad you asked. The New York Voting Rights Act would be the strongest and most comprehensive state voting rights act in the nation, and it really would make New York a national leader when it comes to expanding the franchise. And, you know, it really does a lot for every voter in the state. Right. There are certainly protections in there to make sure that minority voters who have been subject to discrimination in New York for a long time have some equity. But, you know, there's a democracy canon in the law, which makes sure that the election law is being interpreted in a way that favors the voter and that counts votes, that votes are not getting knocked out for nonsensical reasons. There are expanded language access protections in the law. There is a new database which is going to make voting and elections data more easily available so that we're making better data-driven elections policy. You know, it's got a preclearance regime, right? The crown jewel of the Civil Rights Amendment, of the Voting Rights Act 1965, imported into New York law in a way to ensure that we are thinking about racial equity when we're engaging in election administration. So much valuable stuff in there. I was thrilled to hear Governor Hochul, endorse the concept of the State Voting Rights Act in her state of the state. If the bill is sponsored by Senator Myrie, it's got 30 co-sponsors in the Senate. It is picking up steam in the Assembly, and we are really hopeful that it will pass this session and set a standard that other states are already emulating. Connecticut has already introduced a state voting rights act very similar to this that's being debated in the legislature. Other states are looking at this bill as a model. And this also builds off of the work of not only the Federal Voting Rights Act, but credit to other states that have passed Voting Rights Act, including Virginia, Oregon, California, and Washington, which have all been really effective.
Thank you. What an aggressive and encouraging lead for New York to take. I didn't know that, and I'm glad to hear that. And moving back to federal, let me ask this question, and I don't mean to blindside you, but I think it might help summarize where you are, you know, the things that we've discussed today. What do you say to someone, Perry, who says elections have consequences? We now have a conservative majority in the Supreme Court, and it's moving conservatively. Like, that's their view of Shelby. That's their view of Brnovich and other Supreme Court decisions that shave away a little bit here and there, perhaps in the name of preventing fraud. What do you say to people who say this is what happens when you have a conservative majority?
The legitimacy of our democracy depends on public confidence in whether that democracy actually represents the people. And to the extent laws are preventing eligible voters from casting ballots, and we know that they are preventing eligible voters from casting ballots at a rate that vastly outstrips any of the minuscule evidence of fraud, we are undermining confidence in democracy in a way that is going to harm the United States as a republic in the long term.
So this is not a conservative thing. This is a justice and right.
This is a fundamental principles of the Constitution thing, and I hope everyone would support it.
Perry, thank you so much. We are very happy you joined us. And to our listeners, the next ballot box, Wednesday, February 16th at 9 a.m.
Thanks so much for joining us.